Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. It's Travis, and today we're going to do a listener mailbag and listen to some of your questions. We're also going to talk in detail about something that's really kind of crazy. Nelnet is really, something's up over there. I'm not really sure what it is, but if you have loans that you've sent a consolidation application to for Nelnet, or if you have Nelnet loans, I just want to talk about some of the weird things that we're seeing at this moment, and just also just do a general update on the state of student loans for late May, and just talk about some of the things that we think are coming on the horizon. I thought maybe we would start off by doing some listener questions, so we'll do that first, and then we'll jump into the next part of today's episode. So let's get started with a question about the really weird $12,000 10-year forgiveness loophole.
Hi, Travis. My name is Barbara, and I've learned a lot from your podcast and appreciate what you and your team do. My question is, can you get two kinds of forgiveness with the same direct loan consolidation? Now, let me explain what I mean when I say that. I did a double consolidation with four parent plus loans. Each were under $12,000, the original balance. Then I consolidated those four loans with a 2002 undergrad loan that had an original balance of under $12,000. I signed up for the SAVE plan, and now I'm wondering, are those loans going to all be backdated for that 2002 date, as I had anticipated when I did the consolidation? Or now will the under $12,000 loan, 10 years in repayment on SAVE forgiveness kick in individually for each of those loans? How does that work exactly? Thanks.
The thing to think about is really it's your $12,000 amount, like, in total. For those that don't know, the SAVE plan, one of the new parts of the SAVE plan that are being implemented is if you have less than $12,000 that you originally borrowed from undergrad, I guess technically probably or grad school, I suppose, but you can get it forgiven in 10 years. Now, for every thousand, you know, extra, that gets extended essentially a year until you have about $22,000 where it's forgiven in 20 years in the private sector if you're doing the SAVE plan. Actually, for grad loans, it gradually steps up to 25 years for every extra thousand. So for grad loans, it's like, I think, 27,000, where it's at the full 25 years until forgiveness. It's not each individual loan. That would be wonderful if it was, right? But no, if you have, you know, a bunch of loans that are less than $12,000, it does not mean that the SAVE plan gets each of those forgiven in 10 years, even if you end up consolidating them or do something else to them. It's really intended to be something that's going to help borrowers with aggregate balances that are really small with the SAVE plan. Now, this is original balance borrowed. So, you know, if you have more than $12,000, if a lot of that's interest, or, you know, people were in and out of deferment or forbearance or default or something, then you can still get that forgiveness in 10 years. But it's a very strange, complicated stepwise function of 10 years to 20 years of forgiveness between $12,000 and $22,000 of original amount borrowed. And then it's just the standard formula for amounts above that. It's really kind of a fascinating thing. But let's listen to the next listener question.
Hey, Travis. Thanks so much for taking my call, as well as all the support you give us listeners. My question is about Parent Plus loans, as well as the double consolidation loophole. I know last July, the Department of Education added a clarification that consolidated loans that contain a consolidated loan that paid off a Parent Plus loan on or after July 2025 will only be available for ICR. However, there's nothing in the clause that guarantees, and I've seen other videos from other student loan advisors, that's a real possibility that parent borrowers who did the loophole way before 2025 can be kicked off SAVE anytime, especially under a Trump presidency. Do you think this is possible? And then I had a second question about parent borrowers who consolidate after July 2025. Do you think the terms of ICR as it exists today will remain unchanged? A big worry I have that keeps me up at night is that if a conservative government may end up removing the married filing separately exclusion across all IDR plans, that excludes spousal income. Thanks so much for your help, Travis. I really appreciate it.
Okay, first of all, what I've learned in student loans is you can never say never. So in a Trump presidency, if they wanted to move everybody out of SAVE that did a Parent Plus double consolidation, could they? Yeah, they could. Would they? No. And I'll tell you why. First of all, once the process of washing the loans is done, and I hate to say washing because it sounds kind of like money laundering, right, or something like that. But I mean, it's sort of like that's what you do is you kind of wash the loans clean with a double consolidation process, and then you have loans you can get on the SAVE plan. I mean, I think that if the Trump presidency was intending to take people off of the save plan, like on Parent Plus loans, like they could have done that with people that were getting on the repay plan when they were in power 2016 to 2020, right? So think about that. Like a lot of times when we're thinking about what's the worst case scenarios for student loans under a Trump presidency, well, you've got to think about like the fact that there was already a presidency for the first term and, you know, he did essentially nothing except for pause interest, which he did because there was an election coming up. So I think that in a second Trump presidency, yeah, Parent Plus borrowers that did double consolidation would lose the save plan for sure, I think almost. But that's not because of Parent Plus borrowers. That's because they think he would do it to everybody. I think everybody on the save plan would lose the save plan when he's not going to be facing voters again and he has a lot of strong opposition to the save plan in his party, which he'll need support from for a lot of different things. I'm kind of on the record that I think the save plan is toast if Trump wins. Now, what would replace it? I mean, probably something I like to joke. It would be the big, beautiful, you know, golden IDR plan. Maybe IDR gold or something like that. I'm joking, but they probably would just replace it with something that is more generous than repay, but maybe not as generous as save. So let's take another listener question.
Hello, Travis and Student Loan Planner team. I just have a follow-up question about the IDR anniversary date. It should be a pretty quick question. If you are to recertify your income early, does your IDR recertification anniversary date get set to that new month? So in other words, for example, if my anniversary date is in March, but I decide to recertify my income early in the month of September, October, does my anniversary date get pushed out to be in October rather than in March? Thanks.
No, I haven't seen that happen. So, I mean, if you think about it, like then they would be constantly doing work trying to redo people's recertification date, which would be very chaotic and difficult, right? No, you don't do that. That's a little bit of a misconception. Some people think that that's what happens. I think the reality is like we've seen so few recertifications happen en masse among these servicers as they exist now that like there's just a lot of kind of like rumors running around, honestly. And we actually have to see everybody go through a recertification process to have a new normal for that to even be something that we can talk about, right? Because it's just interesting to me how like a lot of times I'll hear people be like super confident, hey, this is how IDR recertification works. And it's like, oh, really? Like, remember the last time we did this in mass was in 2019? So it's been 5 years, you know, since we've actually had to go through a massive recertification. And so that's just something to think about with your payment. Is there a way to game the system with timing of the recertification? I think there could be, specifically if you've got, there's like a guideline that says they ask you 90 days before it's due, and then they tell you it's really due 35 days before your recertification date, and then it's like late if you don't turn it in 10 days before, and you'll miss your payment being recertified if you're doing it without the IRS recertification. If the IRS is doing it for you, then that's just going to happen automatically. So there probably is some gamesmanship that you can do based off of like some published guidance on like when the servicers are supposed to ask you for your information, but that is an example of something that would be too far, of something that I don't think that they would be doing. They wouldn't shift your recertification date. You can shift the recertification date mainly through consolidation. That's the main way to shift it that I know of, at least. So let's take one more listener question.
I'm so confused about my Parent Plus loans. If I consolidate and go on an income-driven plan, my payment doubles to $2,100 a month, which is way more than I can afford. It would also cause me to work for another 3 years while strapping myself. What options do I have?
Yeah, so I mean, this is a perfect example of why I'm so concerned for Parent Plus borrowers after this double consolidation thing ends, because the Department of Ed is just like living in la-la land, in my opinion, because they've got Parent Plus loans that'll continue to be allowed to be uncapped for borrowing. And if you take away the double consolidation loophole, you're taking away the safety valve, because you can't get rid of these really in bankruptcy. And then ICR is 20% of your income with 100% of the poverty line deduction. So that's about 14 grand. Or 15 grand. So think about somebody who's making 30 grand a year. Let's say they're single. Under the ICR formula, they're paying 3 grand per year. They're losing 10% of all of their income. This is somebody that, in terms of federal income taxes, would probably be paying, you know, about 10% on everything above the standard deduction. So in other words, they're like, that's a payment that a lot of people just won't be able to make. And the safety valve of the save plan has been something that's been this lifeline to a lot of people. I would say this to some Parent Plus borrower. If you're a, I would say, lower middle class to middle class income, you need to get onto this double consolidation or else. Like, you'll be screwed if you don't. If you're very low income, the ICR plan works just fine and might work just the same as the save plan. If you have a very low income, then your income-based payment could be zero, right? Your ICR payment could be zero, and the double consolidation is kind of irrelevant. So really, this double consolidation thing for Parent Plus people really helps if you're in this sort of Goldilocks zone of like 30, 40K of income to maybe like 200, 300K of income. You know, if you're way above that, you know, maybe the save plan is kind of difficult to justify unless you have not saved a lot for retirement and you know you will be living, you know, on a lot lower income in retirement than what you're currently making. There will be a lot of strategies still to use Parent Plus forgiveness strategies for folks long-term. Mainly, you would have one person who is mostly going to be living off of Social Security be taking all of the Parent Plus loans. So, you know, in a family where one person was making, let's say, 100 to 200K a year, one person was working kind of off and on and making maybe like 20 to 30K a year working very part-time, well, that person who is working very part-time is probably going to have a very low 401k plan. They're probably going to have a Social Security benefit that would be based off of their spouse's higher income when they reach full retirement age. So there's a lot of strategies that we could, I mean, we could do a whole podcast episode on Parent Plus stuff, and we probably will well before that consolidation deadline happens. But, you know, you can tell it's on people's minds right now, right? Now, I think there's some things that could be on people's minds, and I want to encourage you too to send questions that can be about stuff that's not student loan related. So if you're struggling with something financially at all, it can be about investments, financial planning. It could be about questions you have as a student loan borrower trying to grow your wealth. I'd love to get some more broad questions too. It doesn't have to just be about student loans. Of course, it can be. So if you want to put a question out there that I'll answer personally, go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail and you can just press record on your phone and speak into that, whatever your question is. And I'd love to tackle it. I think that there's a lot of questions out there that people are maybe afraid to ask. So you could also just stay anonymous if you want. If you think it's a dumb question, it's not. Somebody else has the same question. So I just love getting y'all's questions and appreciate that very much. So studentloanplanner.com/voicemail if you want to ask a question. Next, I want to shift into student loan news, just things that are happening. I want to start off the episode talking about Nelnet stuff. So Nelnet in particular right now is a mess. We're getting all these conflicting reports coming out of Nelnet as to whether or not they're still accepting consolidations. They, as of last week, stopped showing up on the consolidation app, which we thought was really strange. They are the only non-Mohela servicer that does consolidations, which is a real concern if you're doing a double consolidation, because it might mean that you have to wait 6 months to be able to process that second consolidation if Nelnet's no longer in the picture accepting consolidations. So this is something that we are very much paying attention to. It's very much something that we are monitoring. We still think that the process of sending paper consolidations to these servicers that are still processed by Advantage, I mean, I meant to say Advantage too if I said that Mohela processes consolidations, but Advantage is the one that processes all the consolidations for the other servicers. The issue is, like, Nelnet was always this very useful tool because they were a different company that did consolidation. So if one servicer is going to handle all consolidations, then it's going to be a little bit more tricky to do some of the things that we help people do. I still think it's very much possible, but it's a little bit more challenging. I wonder a little bit, is Nelnet getting out of the servicing game? Are they trying to push them out of the servicing game? I don't know, right? I mean, back in the day with Navient, I think it's supposed to be Navient because it's supposed to be like Navigate or something like that. But Navient made the conscious decision to get out of student loan servicing. And you know, why did they do that? It's because it represented, I think, something like 5-10% of their income, and it represented, you know, 90%+ of all of their headaches. We could potentially see this as the beginning of Nelnet being less interested in being in the servicing business. I don't know if that's their intention. I don't know if Department of Ed is trying to move away from a for-profit company. That would be another one of my guesses, is probably, you know, this Department of Ed is probably a little bit more hostile to a for-profit servicer. I think that they are also probably hostile to Mohela too, because they haven't done a job, I guess, that this administration would probably describe as acceptable. There was another interesting, speaking of Mohela, there was a little article that came out about some call center it was very much clickbaity, right? It was like former call center employee tells all. Like, I mean, all it said was just like the training they didn't think was adequate, that their supervisor told them to keep people on hold for a while was the allegation made in the article. With Mohila, I think that Department of Ed should either fund them or fire them. That is the two options that I think make sense. Either Mohila needs to be given enough money to do their job properly, or, you know, if they're not going to give them the amount of money, then they should get rid of them if they're thinking that they can get great service for the amount of money they're paying. I mean, I guess one thing that's interesting with all this, right, is when Congress doesn't want to provide a lot of money for people to do their job right, then the service and the quality of the people you can afford to hire with the advice they're giving, it's just all a lot more challenging, right? And this is for all of the servicers, not just Mohila. And one of the reasons why people have had such a difficult time is because of this lack of resourcing. And it's very similar in my mind to like the IRS, right? Like you can't, if you're an individual, call up and get like a really competent answer from like an IRS agent like all the time. I mean, it's gotten a little bit better, but it's still very difficult. And it's just a little bit terrifying as an individual sometimes. You're dealing with a, you know, government agency or government appointed company that's dealing with something with your finances. That company's incentives are what matters and what drives the relationship. And that company, a servicer's goal is just to like hire as few people as possible, get people off the phone, try to just keep things simple, right? As simple as possible. And so given a lot of the people that listen to our show have a lot larger debts than average, simple answers are oftentimes something that will really hurt you. The Nelnet stuff, I think, is pretty interesting with, you know, just kind of whispers that is there something going on with their servicing contract? I mean, I don't know. This is just all speculation. I have no idea. But it certainly seems like this Department of Ed really wants to move towards Department of Ed controlling as much as possible, single point of contact, single website, studentaid.gov to log into. I think they would probably like the system to function very simply and not in a complicated fashion. And I think that's a reasonable thing to wish. But, you know, at the same time, it's like the difference, I guess, is like in Germany and the UK and stuff, universities don't play Michigan versus Ohio State with like billion-dollar TV contracts, right? And these universities, I think, are like the ones that benefit the most from the current student loan system and the unlimited borrowing and stuff. And so I guess there's not a lot of incentive to change. And the SAVE plan is truly so expensive. And given that it wasn't passed through Congress, that like the first time a Republican controls office, they're just going to like get rid of it with something that's not as good. That's what all of the lawsuits that Republicans are filing are signaling, is that, you know, you've got two parties that are very split along educational attainment lines, where, you know, very educated people tend to vote very democratically and people that are working class tend to have more and more moving towards voting for Republicans. And so I think that you're going to start seeing like a lot more divergence on student loan policy, like more than we've ever seen before, where Democrats are like very, very pro things that will help student loan borrowers because that's disproportionately their voters. And Republicans will be very disproportionately against things that will help student loan borrowers, perhaps with the exception of things that help higher income student loan borrowers that might be more likely to be swing voters or Republican voters, right? Things like the student loan interest pause, you know, and being cool with that being extended over and over and over again. That's something that benefited higher income student loan borrowers disproportionately. So a couple other kind of reactions or things to wonder if you've heard about. So the head of the student aid office resigned. I think that's a charitable way to put it. I think that he was fired or told to resign. I think the reason was because of the FAFSA. So the FAFSA thing happened. It was a real debacle up there with like healthcare.gov not working when it was launched, probably. And it's something that's really angered a lot of people. Congress told the Department of Ed, hey, you've got to make a new FAFSA that's simpler and shorter and easier, right? Well, one problem, like the FAFSA was built in like a 1950s programming language called COBOL. And, you know, they probably had to find a bunch of people that are enjoying retirement in Florida that they could find to help like figure out exactly how to change it because it's such an ancient system. And then Department of Ed just didn't realize how much of a lift it was going to be. I mean, I can understand that they just underestimated the project. And then when they took it on, it was like not done well. And as I record this, like it's usually you already have like everybody, everything's wrapped and packed. Everybody knows where they're going. Everybody knows like how they're funding it, all that stuff. Like people still have no clue right now. Like award letters, a lot of places have not gone out. Like people are, have no idea how they're going to pay for stuff. The FAFSA application volume is way down. I think it's like 12% lower than it usually is this time of year, which means like millions of fewer people will probably go to college because of this, or at least hundreds of thousands of fewer people will go to college because of this. So there's very, very much real world impacts. And anytime that something goes wrong in government, like, you know, the people in charge are going to need to hold someone accountable. And that person was the head of the student aid office. Now, technically, maybe it's unfair to say that, like maybe he just resigned because he wanted to pursue other things. But I think it's more likely given the timing that they essentially said somebody's head's got a roll, so it might as well be you. I don't know. That is a pretty big change. Another thing to think about in terms of like what will happen with this election coming up is the person that was appointed head of that student aid office was someone that was very much, and I'm borrowing language from the Association of Financial Aid Administrators podcast on this, but they have called the head of the student aid office, you know, a political appointee effectively. And there's a big movement among the policy wonk kind of people to make the head of the student aid office like kind of like a chairman of the Fed kind of position. And the reason there is because the idea is you put some sort of technocrat in charge, that they're not like somebody who's trying to achieve administration's policy goals. They're somebody who's just trying to make sure the trains run on time kind of thing in terms of like all the technical stuff working correctly, all the FAFSA forms, the financial aid process, like all being professionalized, right? Not like subject to who's in office of what things do they want to accomplish. And the cat's out of the bag there. You know, if Trump wins re-election, I think he'd probably do the same, a similar thing, and appoint. Now, the Department of Education secretary is obviously always a political appointee, but I think that you could see the student aid office more politicized than it's been in the past. So I think that you would see maybe somebody who is, for lack of a better word, anti-woke, right, that gets appointed, then maybe they'd be a lot more focused on using like student aid as like a potential cudgel or something that they could use to get universities more aligned with what they're trying to achieve as an administration. I don't know. I'm just speculating. I think that there's a lot of stuff that's going to happen in the next few weeks that will set the tone for the rest of the year on student loans. I think that we're going to see the massive unveiling of like this sweeping forgiveness program for like accrued interest. So it's going to be, just to recap what that is, that's like if you have the same income limits as the cancellation program, you're going to get up to all of your accrued interest canceled. Again, not like 10 to 20K, like all of it. And then everybody would get that 10 to 20K interest canceled, you know, if you have that up to that amount, if you're above those income limits. And then there's all kinds of like over a dozen hardship categories people could apply for and get all their loans canceled as well. This is going to run into a legal obstacle as soon as it's formally filed. And I'm not sure exactly when that'll be, but it could be any week now that we could see that program rolled out. And then we'll see a lot of pushback as soon as that's released. We've got some ongoing lawsuits too that are X factors. The SAVE plan, right, is being sued over right now, like literally as we speak. And in a world where the SAVE plan falls, what replaces it? Well, if something worse than the SAVE plan is introduced, well, now you've got like the IBR plan, old IBR, new IBR, which is in the statute. And then you've got whatever the current administration in power wants to push, which could be Repay, it could be SAVE, it could be this College Cost Reduction Act plan, which is kind of like in between SAVE and Repay. That's the latest GOP plan and proposal. And then, you know, there's always another X factor of like Congress deciding, hey, we want to reform the student loan system completely because we have decided it's finally time. Like they tried to reform FAFSA, but look how that's gone. You reform something and then it's can be often a disaster or a giant mess. So the broad message of student loans being an income tax in America is still the accurate way to think about it until you have such a good income that it's no longer a good idea to think of it as an income tax. It's just a payment. But we'll be monitoring this closely for you to make sure that you're fully informed with all of the stuff that's going to happen on student loans between now and the election. And then based off of who wins, then I think that we're going to see a lot of like really interesting changes, right? I think if it's Biden, you might see like a major like legislative overhaul of student loans. If it's Trump, I think you're going to see a massive rollback of stuff on student loans that Biden did. I do think that if you've already gotten forgiveness or if you're getting forgiveness credit from consolidations or something, I think that's locked in. But a lot of the programs that are available will get significantly curtailed depending on how that goes. And we've also got a presidential debate coming up, which is shocking, in a few weeks, and maybe they'll mention student loans. I don't know. I mean, there's no concrete policy proposals that I've heard at all from Trump on student loans. It'll be interesting to see if student loans become an important part of the election conversation, or if they stay on the back burner and other things like inflation and the economy and immigration and stuff are the main focal points. But I could actually see President Biden having an incentive to like ramp up his discussion of this, just because of who he needs to activate to win, right? Younger voters. He needs to energize younger voters. So if you have any questions about from the pod today, if you want to talk about just investing stuff, financial planning, random questions that don't pertain to student loans at all, but you're a student loan borrower and you have financial questions and you just want to understand like how buying a house should work in this interest rate environment when you've got all these loan bills to pay, right? Like whatever's on your mind, I'd love to hear it. So studentloanplanner.com/voicemail if you want to leave a question that we'll answer in a future episode. And of course, if you need any help with your student loans, studentloanplanner.com/book. Thanks everyone for listening to the Student Loan Planner podcast. Have a great rest of your week.